There's really not a great deal to be said about this story. It tells itself in straightaway terms and makes its moral, I feel, somewhat heavily at the end. As I recall, I wrote it while I was in the U.S. Army, stationed in Kentucky, and I'm not at all certain it was written for money. I think there was some of my horror at the Southern intellect hinted at in it. This may seem obscure since this is a science fiction story about a circus and a group of telepaths, but for one who was for many years a Mickey Mouse parlor liberal, it was the first genuine stirrings of a social conscience. We allow terrible things to happen and turn our faces away in horror, but we never commit ourselves. Either we feel we are not in a position to do any good, ludicrous when examined closely, or we cop out intellectually, rationalizing the nature of the crime and the nature of the struggle in the deepest, most esoteric, and most cheaply hypocritical terms. There's a song the kids in SNCC sing. It goes, "Which side are you on?" And that, friends, is where it's at. You're either for or against. The time for fence sitting is long past. Excuse the militancy. All this is from the viscera and has very little to do with Big Sam was my friend. I guess working for a teeper circus ain't the quietest work in the galaxy, but what the dickens, it's more than just a buck, and you see a lot of the settled worlds, and there's always enough Quaalette around to keep a guy happy, so why should I kick? By that, I mean, so what if they did lynch my friend Big Sam out on Julu too? So what? You can always find another friend someplace around. But every time I start thinking that way, I kick myself mentally and say, Johnny Lee, you got to stop passing Sam off like that. He was a good friend. He was a sick man, and he couldn't help what he did, but that's no call to be passing him off so quick. Then I'd start to remember the first time I'd ever seen Big Sam. That was outside Shreveport. Not the old Shreveport, but the one on Burris, with the green sandhills just beyond in the dusk. We were featuring Dolly Blaze that time. She was a second-stage pyrotic with a cute little trick of setting herself on fire, and what with her figure what it was, well, it wasn't much of a trick, even for a drum banger like me, to kick up some pretty hot publicity about the circus. It was the second show, and we'd packed the tent full, which wasn't odd because 200 Burrites, each as big as an elephant and looking a little bit like elephants with those hose proboscises, crammed our pneumo tent till there was hardly room for the hawkers to mill through, when I spotted him. It wasn't so strange to spot a homebody from Earth on a ridge world, what with the way we Earthmen move around, but there was something odd about this homebody. Aside from the fact that he was close to 7 feet tall. It wasn't long till I spotted him as a teeper of some sort. At first, I figured him for a clairvoyant, but I could tell from the way he watched the acrobats, they were a pair of Hungarian floaters called the Spindotties, and the only way they could have fallen was to lose their teep powers of anti-grav altogether. The way he tensed up when they were making a catch that he couldn't read the future. Then I figured him for an empath, and that would have been useless for the circus, except in an administrative capacity, of course, to tell us when one of the performers was sick or unhappy or a bad crowd or like that. But right then, credits were tight and we couldn't afford an empath, so I counted him off. But as I watched him sitting there in the stands between two big-as-houses Burrites sucking up pink lemonade from squeeze bulbs, I discounted the empath angle, too. I didn't realize he was a teleport until Fritz Bravery came on with his animal pack. In our circus, we clear both side rings for the central circle when a specialty act goes on. Then the fluoro bands are jockeyed into position over the center ring and the mini tapes set their reaction music for all bands. That way we draw attention to the big act only. Fritz Bravery was an old-timer. He had been a lion tamer in a German circus back home before teeping was understood and various types outlined. That was when Fritz had found out the reason he was so good with animals was that he was what the French had labeled animaux voyeur, which in English, the way we accept it now, means he and the beasts think alike, and he suggests to them, and like, they just go through hoops if he thinks, jump through a hoop. But Fritz was also one of those hearkeners after the old days. He thought showbiz was dead, nothing but commercial and plebeian crap left. You know, one of those. And he had lost his wife Gert somewhere between Madison Square Plaza and Burris, and eventually the old joy juice had grabbed him. That night, old Fritz's bravery was juiced to the ears. You could spot it the moment he got into the ring with the beasts. He was using three big Nubian lions and a puma and a dree and a sligor those days. Plus, one mean bitch of a black panther called Felice, the likes of which, for downright cussedness, I've never seen. Old Fritz got with them and he was shaky from the start. King Groth, who ran the show, looked at me and I looked at him, and we both thought, I hope to God Fritz can handle them tonight with his senses all fogged up like that. But we didn't do anything because Fritz always had his escape plate ready to lift him over their heads if he got into trouble. And besides, it was his act. We had no right to cramp it before he'd shown his stuff. But King murmured in my ear, better start looking around for a new catman, Johnny. Fritz won't be good much longer. I nodded and felt sort of sad because Fritz was as good a catman as we'd ever had with the circus. The old man went around them, walking backward with his electro whip snapping and sparking sweetly, and for a while, everything was fine. He even had the lions and the puma up in a tricky pyramid with the black panther about to leap up the backs of the five lions to take her place at the apex of the pyramid. He pulled off that number pretty well, though one of the lions stumbled as the pyramid was breaking up and growled at him. We had grown to know the difference between a show growl, commanded mentally by Fritz for fright effect in the act, and a real one. A real one free of Fritz's control. That was this last one. So we knew old Fritz was losing control. We grew more alert as he herded the lions and the puma into the corner of the force cage in which he performed his act. It was transparent around the four walls, but there nonetheless. Then Fritz, ignoring Felice, who followed the other earth beasts, went to work on the dree. He got her to rotate on all 16 and hump and then turn inside out, which is a pretty spectacular thing considering a dree's technicolor innards. Then he got it to lift him on one appendage and place him gently on another all the way up the length of her body from appendage to appendage. Then he worked for a while with the sligor. It was poisonous, so he donned gloves and used the sonic whistle on it alone, since electricity didn't affect it in any way. Even his work with the sligor was fair that night, and for a while, we thought he would make it fine. I kept tossing this 7-foot homebody in the stands a look from time to time, trying to decide what sort of a teep he was, but he was just watching the act and smiling and not doing a thing. Then Fritz went to work on Felice. She had been inverse shipped from Earth not more than 3 weeks before, and the trip through inverse space, coupled with her natural instinctive nastiness, and more than likely allied with some temperament quirk aggravated by the warping of the ship and its occupants through inverse space, had left her a jangle-nerved, heaped-up body of hate and fury. We had had several close calls with her nipping her feeder robots, and I, for one, didn't like to see old Fritz in there with her. But he was determined to break her. Showmanship and all that bourgeois, so we let him go ahead. After all, he did have the escape plate there, which whisks him anti-gravitically over the heads of the animals should there be trouble. He picked up his electro whip and moved in on Felice. She sat crouched back on her haunches, waiting him out. He stopped a foot from her, so close he could have stroked her sleek black fur. Then he did a double movement, crack, crack, with the electro whip, and caught her on the snout with a spark. Felice leaped. At that precise instant, the most remarkable thing I've ever glommed in all my days as a flack for a top happened. I've never yet been able to figure it out whether the beasts were actually in mental contact with one another or it was just chance, but the puma got to its feet and softly padded over to the escape plate and sat down on it. The lions moved out and positioned themselves around the force cage. Fritz was hemmed in completely. Then Felice began stalking him. It was the most fascinating and horrifying thing I've ever seen, to witness that big cat playing footsie with old Fritz. The tamer tried to control her, but even from where we were in the stands, we could see the sweat on his face and the dark lines etched against the white of his face. He was scared. He had lost control of them completely. He knew he was dead. Felice's eyes were two barbs ready to impale poor old Fritz, and we were so stunned. It all happened so quickly. We just sat there, and so help me God, we just watched. I felt like a Roman in the arena. Felice crouched again, and the muscles in her black shoulders hunched and bunched and tensed, and she sprang full on old Fritz. He fell down, and her crushing weight landed atop him, and her jaws opened wide with yellow fangs straining yowpingly for Fritz Bravery's neck. Her head came up and back, and her throat was stretched tight so the pulse of a blood vein could be seen, and then the head came down like the blade of a guillotine, but Fritz wasn't there. He was sitting up in the stands with the 7-foot homebody. That was when I knew. Hell, anybody'd be able to tell by then. He was a teleport, the best kind, an outgoing teleport. He had teeped Fritz out of the jaws of the Black Panther. I looked at King Groth, who was looking from Felice to Fritz and back, not knowing I had already tagged the homebody as a teeper, and there was amazement on his face. "We got us a new star act, King," I said, slipping out of my seat. I cocked a thumb at Fritz, who was talking bewilderedly to the 7-foot homebody. I started threading my way between the elephant big burrites toward Fritz and his savior. Behind me, I heard King Groth saying, "Go get him, boy." I got him. Now, I won't bother going into the year Big Sam spent with the circus. It was pretty routine. We covered the Stardust route from Burris to Lilliay to Crown Colony to Peck's Orchard to Moulton Xilil. They have a treaty there with the natives, so long as they use both homebody and native name for the planet, to Ringling and right along the ridge to the new cluster worlds of Donza, Jowlak, Min, Thornwire, and Julu 2. That was where we lost Big Sam, there on Julu 2, where they lynched him. But to understand what happened, why it happened, I'd better tell you about Big Sam. Not just that he was nearly 7 feet tall, with a long, horsey face and high cheekbones and dark, sad blue eyes, but about him, what he was like. And this is the best way to tell it. Sam's act consisted of several parts. For instance, at the beginning, we turned off all the fluoro bands. Then, 3 roustabouts clanked out, carrying this big pole in their metal arms. They would kick off the cover plate of the hole we had sunk in the floor of the arena, or tent, and insert the pole in it, then clamp it so it was rigid. Then one of the Rastabots would switch on the torch finger of his utility hand and set fire to the pole. We had already doused it in oil, and the thing caught fire up its length till there was a pillar of fire in the middle of the ring. It was a specially treated pole and didn't really burn, though the fire on it was real enough, so we used the same pole over and over. Then the ringmaster would swoop in on his plate and his sonic voice would boom out at the audience, "Ladies and gentlemen, I draw your attention to the center ring where the galaxy's most mystifying, most extraordinary artiste will perform for you. I am proud to present the unbelievable Hugo." That was Sam. Then the one spot would go on, like the eye of a god, and pick out Sam, striding across the plastidust. Sawdust went out with the high cost of inverse shipping. He would be wearing skin-tight black clothing that accentuated his slim build and high-topped black boots, very soft and with 2-inch soles to make him seem even taller, and a black cape with a crimson lining. Hell of a look, let me tell you. He would advance to the center of the ring, just beside the burning pole, and raise his arms. A girl wearing spangles and not much else, that was Beatrice, whom I had been dating when she wasn't on her iron filing kick, but that's another story, fortunately, would run out and take his cape, and Hugo, that's Sam, would turn and look at the pole for a long minute. Then he would take a running leap, hit the pole, and start to shinny up. Everyone would shriek. He was being burned to death. Then he was gone. And a second later, he was at the top of the pole on the little platform above the flames. Everyone was astonished. For some reason, they never realized he was a teleport. I guess there aren't many teleports around, and most people don't see them as flagrantly displaying their talents as Big Sam did. It's a recessive trait. For a moment, he would poise himself there on toe tip as the audios skirled their danger music on all bands, and then as the drums rolled, Sam would do a neat swam dive off the platform. The shrieking would get even bigger then. He would turn a gainer, a flip, a half gainer, and then, just as it seemed he was about to smash full force into the ground, he disappeared and reappeared, standing lightly on the balls of his feet in the same position he had been when he started, his arms widespread over his head, an enigmatic grin splitting his craggy features. That was the first part of his act. The applause was always deafening, and we never had to modify it by taped responses either. Isn't that beyond belief? To see an almost certain horrible death, you know how crowds all sit on the edge of their seats, praying subconsciously for a spectacular accident, and then to be whisked away from it so suddenly, brought to the edge of tragedy and then to have their better natures win out, showing them how much nicer they always knew they were, that was the supreme thrill. But it was merely a beginning. Then Hugo, Sam, did juggling, magnificent high-flown juggling with hundreds of knives and fireballs and even 1,000-pound weights, moving them all by teleportation. Then he wrestled with the bear, slipping out of the most fearsome grips as easily as a greased fish. Then came the tennis match he played with himself. He beat himself in straight sets. His act was sensational. For on many of the Outer Ridge worlds, they had had little or no truck with teleports. By the service system for TEEPs, each of the categories had to send representative members to the Ridge Worlds to serve tours, to spread homebody technology and advantages around, but there were so few teleports, they had been rarely seen. So Big Sam was a novelty, and as such, he dragged the credits for us. I played him big. But there was more to Sam than just the tricks. We used to sit alone at night under a saffron sky, or a mauve sky, or an ebony sky, and talk. I liked talking to him because he wasn't dumb, like most of the washed-up and used-up carny creeps we had with us. He had been an educated man, that was obvious, and there was a deep, infinite sadness about him that sometimes made me want to cry just talking to him there. I remember the night I found out how sick Big Sam really was. That was on Rorspokine 1, a little plug of a world by all rights we should have avoided, but a combination of low money for paychecks, repair work for the ships, and general all-around lethargy had set us down on that whistle stop for a 3-week set. Mostly, we just puttered around and killed time resting up till the big 6-month tour on Julu 2. That night, Big Sam and I lay back with our heads on grassy mounds, staring up at the night that was deep blue, with the stars ticking away eternity over us. I looked over at the rough topography of his face and asked him, "Sam, what the hell is a guy like you doing out on the fly like this?" His face tightened all over. It was so odd, the way he looked, so tight, like my question had sucked all the life from him. "I'm looking for a dead girl, Johnny Lee." He always pronounced my name as though it were one word only. His answer didn't sink in for a second. I didn't want to push, but I felt somehow this was the first opening up he had ever given me. "Oh? How'd that happen?" "She died a long time ago, Johnny. A long time ago." His eyes closed. He no longer saw the stars. "She was just a girl, Johnny. Just another girl. And I guess I was more in love with the idea of love than with her." I didn't say a word. For a long time, neither did he. Then, when I was starting to fall asleep and thought he already had, he went on. "Her name was Claire. Nothing very pretentious about her. So simple and clean. I wanted very much to marry her. I don't know why, we were nothing alike. Then one day, we were walking, and I don't know what it was, just something, you know, and I teleported away from her, half a block away. I didn't know then quite what I could do. I had never teleported in front of Claire. I suppose it was a shock to her. She was a no-talent, and it must have shocked her. I could see she was repulsed by the idea of it. I'd been sleeping with her, Johnny, and I guess it was pretty foreign. Like finding out the guy you'd been making love to was an android or some such. She ran away. I was so shocked at her attitude, I just didn't follow her. Then I heard a screech, and she screamed, and I teleported to the source of the scream, and she'd been hit by a truck trying to cross the street. Oh, it wasn't my fault, nothing like that, and no guilt complex or anything, but, well, you know, I had to get away from things, so I took to the fly, just like that." He was finished. I said, "Just like that. You ever going back, Sam?" He shook his head. "I don't suppose so. I'll find her someday." I said, "Huh?" He glanced over, and there was a hurt in his eyes. "Yeah, I suppose I never told you this. Probably think it's a crazy idea. Everyone else does. She's in heaven." "Nothing crazy about that, Sam," I said, big magnanimous that I was. "Heaven is out here somewhere." That stopped it. I was back to, "Huh?" He nodded again. "Out here on one of these is heaven. That's where she is. I'll find her." He waved at the stars overhead. I followed his arm. Up here? Heaven? On an alien world? I didn't say anything. Crazy? No, I don't suppose it's any crazier than any other idea of heaven or hell, I replied soberly. It gave me the creeps, frankly. I'll find her. I sure hope so, Sam. I sure hope so. He fell asleep before I did. Who could sleep with something like that to scare the crap out of you? We hit Julu 2 on a Thursday, and by the following Friday, a week, we had a command performance scheduled for the Julun royalty. It was a wonderful deal. Once we had performed and pleased the court, our success on Julu 2 was assured because they had a real monarchy plus set up on that world. And if the court liked us, the high glub-glub or whatever the hell they called the king would send out a proclamation ordering all his subjects to attend or suffer some penalty. So we'd be all set. We ran through the acts in the palace, which was a great mansion, twice as big as our pneumo tent, and I've got to admit, even washed out Dolly Blaze and Fritz Bravery and the rest were magnificent. But, of course, Sam stole the show. They had never seen a teleport on Julu 2, and Sam was at his sparklingest best. He was more daring and unusual than ever. There was even a trick with Felice that had everyone gasping and finally chuckling. When it was over, the king and his court invited us to a huge banquet and ceremonial party. It was the greatest. They had huge platters of fried and braised meats, bowls of planetary fruits, tankards of ales and liqueurs that were direct lineal descendants of ambrosia. It was the greatest. Then they brought on the dancing girls, and they were even better. I spotted one smooth-limbed little number I decided to approach with dalliance in mind after everyone had settled down a little. The Julans were homebody type right down to their navels, and I wasn't worried about picking up any alien equivalents of VD. Besides, she had the cutest little popo I'd seen in months. Beatrice, the girl who assisted Sam and who I had been shacking with, was eyeing me, and eyeing a handsome brute, all tanned and wearing bronze armor, who was guarding one of the big doors, I decided to let her cheat on me, thus leaving the road clear for the little dancer. The party was well underway when the king stood up and made some big deal announcement about us being just in time to see the sacred virgin ceremony of Julu 2, which occurred but once every 25 years. He even hinted it had been moved up a few weeks to accommodate us in this hour of circus triumph. We all applauded and watched as they set up a high platform made of ever smaller gold risers. It was quite a thrill. We were all gathered around at the one end of the ceremonial hall with the pyramid of risers at the other. We weren't interested in the least about this ceremony. But to be polite, we watched as they set up some sort of chopping block affair and put two burning braziers beside the block. It was getting more interesting by the moment. While most of the circus folk were still gorging themselves on the foods and fruits overflowing the table, Sam and I turned full around to watch this. I heard him mumble something about picturesque native ceremonies and nodded my head. The king signaled to one of his bully boys, and the bully boy swung a long-handled clapper at a tapestry hanging from floor to ceiling beside him. They must have had a gong concealed behind it because the sound almost deafened me. Then the king, of his title I'm not sure, but his rank was obvious, spoke for a few minutes on the history and traditions of the sacred virgin ceremony. We didn't really listen too closely, mainly because he was speaking in similes and the noise from the crowd around us drowned him half out. But in a little while, we got the impression this was very important stuff to the Julans, And when the king clapped his hands, we turned to the gang and tried to get them to shut up. Those slobs would rather eat than think. They didn't shut up till the gong sounded again, but when the gray-hooded man with the gigantic meat cleaver brought the pretty blonde girl out onto the platform, they all signed off like we'd cut their vocal cords. She was a magnificently beautiful creature. Her hair was long and blonde, and her body was full and straight, her eyes the deepest and most lustrous brown I've ever seen. The executioner, hell yes, that's what he was, helped her over to the block, and her face was very calm. Calm, it seemed, the way someone's face would be if they were dying of cancer and knew they could do nothing about it. But this young girl wasn't dying of cancer. She was about to have that gray-hooded man chop off her head. It was apparent that was what was about to happen. A sacrificial ceremony. The hooded man helped her to kneel before the block, and she lay her head in the notch. The executioner pulled her hair away from her neck gently and laid it over her left shoulder in a long blonde streamer. Then he tested his hatchet's edge and stepped back. He planted his feet wide apart and swung the axe up. Everyone screamed, and it sounded like a million buzz saws. Before anyone could do anything, the executioner brought the axe down, almost touching her neck to get the proper placement for the real swing. That was when I heard Sam's muted gurgle. He had been mumbling there beside me for over a minute, and I hadn't realized it. I was so engrossed in watching the tableau on the chopping block. Then I heard him mutter, "Claire." And I knew there was going to be trouble. I saw him stand up out of the corner of my eye, and as the executioner swung the axe up in a two-handed whirl, Sam disappeared from beside me, and in the next instant, before the blade had a chance to fall on that lovely neck, he was there. His arm snaked around the gray-hooded man's neck, and his hand shot out to catch the descending handle of the axe. He wrenched the death tool from the man's hand and threw it with a spinning clatter to the floor of the chamber, far below the pyramid. Then his fist came back and caught the hatchet man across his hidden face. The executioner stumbled, and Sam doubled him over with a belly blow that made the face behind the gray hood scream. Sam straightened him with a right to the tip of the jaw, and the hatchet man went caroming off the pyramid. He landed with a sick thump. The king was on his feet, livid with rage, and the court was screaming, "Profanity, outrage, transgression." The king clapped his hands, and a dozen of the tanned bully boys, one of whom was the hog Beatrice had been ogling, raced onto the pyramid and grabbed Sam around the waist, the neck, the legs, and, of course, he teleported out of their grip. He was back beside me. The king was leaping up and down, screeching at the top of his lungs to get that man. Sam stood impassively, waiting. Then King Groth walked over and said, "Stand still, Sam. Let's find out how much damage you've done." He went to talk to the other king. Groth was a sharp operator, and if anyone could pour oil on the waters, it was him. We watched as he talked to the king, who was getting more furious and apoplectic by the moment. "Sam, Sam," I said quietly, "why did you do it? For Christ's sake, why?" He looked at me and said, "This isn't much like heaven, is it?" Then I knew he had found Claire. The blonde girl still kneeled beside the chopping block. She had not moved except to raise her head from the notch. King Groth came back, and his face was gray. "Sam, they say you have to die." Big Sam looked at him and didn't say a word. I don't think he cared, really. "Look, Sam, we're going to fight this. They can't do it to a homebody. We can fight it. Don't worry." The king rushed over and started to screech something. "Listen," I piped in, just to stop him. "He is a sick man. He didn't know what he was doing. You have to remember, he knows nothing of your local customs." It didn't make a bit of difference. "He must die. That is the reward for interrupting the sacred virgin ceremony." We argued and hassled and made a big stink out of it, and I think the only reason we all didn't gallop out of there and pull up stakes was that we were afraid we'd all be held and executed, and Big Sam was the only teleport in the crowd. And there was something else, something I'm afraid and ashamed even today to say. I think we were all afraid of losing the business. That's right. Pretty disgusting, ain't it? We could have set Dolly Blaze to burning the joint, and we could have escaped. We could have done at least 100 things to distract the Julians. But we were afraid we'd lose the business. And we were almost willing to let the man die for that. Finally, though, the king said, "We must leave it to the sacred virgin, then. Let her decision be the one." That sat okay with us. We wanted a way out so bad, then it didn't matter. And we all looked at Sam. Softly, the hurt came back into his eyes, and a softness surrounded his mouth, and he nodded. "That's fine," he said, simply. We all walked up to the pyramid and looked at her. She was very clean and simple-looking, just the way I'd imagined Sam's Claire might have looked. We all stared at her, and with a sneer, she snarled, "Let him die!" And that was that. They took him up to the block, and they removed her, and they shoved Sam's head into the notch. Then someone made the motion that he be hanged, because the block was reserved for the sacred virgin. So they strung up a fiber rope right there in that beautiful hall, and they put it around Sam's neck, and 10 men got on the other end of the rope that hung over a beam from above. And we just watched. Can you understand that? We just stood there and watched as Sam was prepared for hanging. I tried to stop them. Finally, I suppose I came out of my trance. "Wait, you can't do this!" But King Groff and 2 of the performers grabbed me by the arms and held me. "This is their world, Johnny. Let them do what they have to do." And Sam looked at me, and I could see in his eyes that it didn't matter to him. It was the same hurt all over again. He had been wrong. He did have a hag riding him about Claire's death. This was one way to clear it off. They yanked on the rope, and Sam went up. He hardly twisted or kicked or twitched. I couldn't watch, because there were a couple of things that made me ill way deep inside. The first was knowing King Groth and the circus and even myself had sacrificed this nice, quiet guy with a problem for the sake of a credit. And the other thing, the thing that really stopped us from trying to help him, I think, was that Sam wanted to die. He could have teeped out of that noose at any moment, but he didn't. He let them lynch him. He had squared away with Claire. We finished our tour on Julutu. Sam had been right. It wasn't much like heaven.